Welcome to Lost in Transformation. This is Ming Labs, podcasting from Singapore, an international innovation center, business hub, and startup supporter. Learn from digital thought leaders and designers about innovation and transformation of businesses in an ever-evolving digital world. Coming up is your host, Sebastian Müller, COO of Ming Labs, together with our guest for today, John Howell. Originally from Australia, John is the principal consultant with Innovator SG, a strategy consultancy based in Singapore and active throughout Asia. John has lots of experience in transformation programs that use digital design sprints and methodologies like design thinking and systems thinking across various industry sectors. He has also assisted Singapore government agencies and universities with foresight work such as Action Plan Singapore 2026. In this episode, learn more about problem structuring, systems and design thinking, and common mistakes in transformation efforts. We hope you enjoy the conversation and look forward to your feedback.
So, hey, John. Thank you very much for taking the time being with us today.
Always a pleasure.
Maybe to get started, if you could just tell us a little bit about what you've done in the past. What got you to starting this company that you're running today, Innovator?
Okay. So I have a background largely in digital agency. So that sort of brought me to a space where I looked at the gap between the business understanding of technology and the technologist understanding of technology. So Innovator was actually founded by Victor, my business partner, about 10 years ago in Europe. And he noticed that same sort of divide between the technology experts and the people in the business who, as the world gets more complex, as technology gets more complex, it gets increasingly hard to have that conversation to get a productive outcome.
So how do you then set out to bridge that gap?
It's really creating a space where people can have the kind of conversations they need to have. So essentially, we look at where is the business or the business unit now versus where it wants to be or needs to be. Look at the barriers that people need to overcome to get to that desired outcome and design a process that can get them through to the desired outcome.
So when people think about Innovator, to understand a bit your value proposition also, how do people think about you? How do you come into their frame of mind? What are you there to help them with?
Yeah, so I think it's when people feel like there's some kind of change in the business and they've realized that just on existing resources, it's difficult to move forward. So sometimes it might happen that there's a management team that they've become logged jammed on a project, and there might be a complex mix of different business unit perspectives, legacy, older new process, older new technology, and they just realize that they need an external facilitator to bring the conversation forward. That can be one use case. Another use case can be where we're just not sure of what to do next in terms of a roadmap, or it can even be we just want to find a way to improve in the business and we're not sure what, and they feel like getting an external party in can help them to have that conversation effectively.
Why is it important to bring in somebody from the outside versus maybe finding somebody else on the inside who's currently not part of that process to try to help them move forward?
Yeah, it doesn't have to be an external. It's just that often organizations get to the point where either there's a logjam has happened, or they realize that you might be a manager who's actually got skills in facilitation, but you want to actually participate from a content perspective. You want to have an opinion. You want to have a say. And to facilitate and also participate from a content perspective at the same time is actually difficult to do.
Yeah.
And it becomes a bit political as well. So having someone who's a clean skin, someone who doesn't have a vested interest in a particular view, who's seen as neutral, can be useful to help bring the conversation forward.
Right. So what are the limitations of that approach? Where would you say, okay, we can get in at this point, but then when it reaches this stage, we're out again because, guys, you have to do this yourself.
Yeah. It really depends on what the external party's being brought in to do. If they've been brought in from a subject matter expertise or industry content expertise perspective, probably they've been brought in to find out what is the best practice or emerging best practice in the industry, how might we implement some of those things. And that can be a legitimate approach. I guess it's a question of, are they looking at digitalization of an existing set of processes or digital transformation, which is like a digital first rethink of a whole set of processes or indeed the whole business model. What we do is more on the process facilitation end. So we're not going in to contribute subject matter expertise in terms of what they need to decide. It's more that we draw out the expertise either from the internal experts, or we can bring in subject matter experts or even agency partners who can contribute that kind of expertise. What we're really doing is providing a process that allows the right kind of conversation to happen.
Because these conversations don't really happen naturally within the company.
Exactly. The natural way of doing things tends to lead to some kind of logjam, which can actually take years to be cleared. And this can happen even at the best international organizations.
Why do you think that is? What are the dynamics that often lead to these kinds of things? And do you think they're preventable?
I think there's complexity and there's habits and there's legacy. So complexity is ever increasing, not just in technology, but in regulation and process. Roles, professional tasks and roles are fragmented increasingly. So it gets harder and harder to have the productive conversations that are necessary. Really having the understanding and the skills to understand where everyone's coming from, that can be quite difficult because it's easy to get embedded in your own habitual ways of thinking.
Right.
So I'd have to say it can be silos, it can be professional specializations. There's any range of reasons why you get stuck in your own way of thinking. And to an extent, there's nothing wrong with that. But when it comes a time to have a transformational conversation, there needs to be a way to sort of be lifted out of that habitual way of thinking so you can move the conversation forward.
So when you do that, do you also think that the physical space is actually an important consideration? Do you take people out of the day-to-day workspace and try to get them out of that way of thinking?
Yeah, it's usually useful to get them out of the physical workspace because that has a particular effect on human psychology. If you get them off-site, usually it encourages them to think more broadly. And really to see people in a new way, see situations in a new way, we usually like to get people to an offsite if that's possible. But, you know, it can also be doable to do it on-site. It's not necessary to necessarily get them completely away from the office. I did one recently in Bali, though, which was a lot of fun. So we took the entire management team to Bali, you know, and spent 2 days there looking at what have they been doing for the past year? I mean, they've got some amazing achievements and wins, but they also looked at things that are holding them back, problems that might come up in future and how they're going to tackle those and really looking at what they need to prioritize for the next year going forward.
And do you have any view on how they would then take a conversation like that back into their day-to-day to really make a change?
Yeah, I just had a conversation with one of the senior managers in that organization and pleased to report that of the four projects that they identified, they're moving ahead at full steam and they've already had a big efficiency gain. I mean, I think that's partly just that they're a really great team who are able to take that and run with it. But it's also part of getting people to really have those deep conversations and spend enough time that they feel that it's a priority for them to work together and move things forward.
Right. One of the things that you do is called problem structuring.
Yeah.
What is that all about?
Problem structuring is kind of born of the realization that there's a big problem in virtually every organization these days called solution jumping. And it's born of the fact that there are any number of solutions out there. It's getting increasingly easy with the consumerization of IT. You can get a credit card and sign up for cloud-based service, many of which are amazing and highly useful. But organizations are faced with the reality that if they just throw technology at a problem without really deeply understanding the problem and getting consensus in the organization around what are the priorities they need to solve, you can end up with expensive solutions that don't get used.
Right.
Or even you can get to a situation where if you just put technology on the back of an old process, a good friend of mine, Nicholas Kontopoulos, likes to tell his clients that old process plus new technology equals expensive old process. So that's usually gets a laugh from people who are familiar with these kind of challenges and problems. But just say you use a chatbot for customer service and you don't update the policies and procedures that cause anger to your customers, having a chatbot handling customer service more efficiently might just anger customers faster if you don't actually change the underlying processes. So this is the difference between digital transformation and digitization. If you just put technology on top of the problem, you might just make the problem anger customers faster. So you asked about problem structuring. Problem structuring is really to get a bunch of your key people in the room. It can be internal people. It can also be customers, but usually it starts with internal people from different business units to look at what are our hopes and fears for the next 2 years or 5 years, whatever time horizon you're facing, and to prioritize what are the main things we want to achieve, what are the main things we're afraid of. Problems are things that usually we are compared to icebergs. So we're just talking at the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
And I like to say that that ship in 1912 that hit the iceberg, the Titanic, if it had hit the iceberg head on, it wouldn't have sunk. But the fact that it tore out the side of the ship, it didn't approach the problem in the right way, or it didn't manage to stop before it hit the iceberg, caused a disaster. So what we'd like to do is go deep, deep into the iceberg, if you will. When you have the right kind of collaboration around a problem, we like to say a problem well-defined is a problem half-solved, and a problem shared is a problem halved. So I'm probably mixing metaphors here, but if you do the math there.
That's already a quarter of a problem, man.
Hopefully it's a quarter of a problem, but the problem is we haven't really been taught how to do strategy, or if we have, we've been taught in business school and it's a case study and everything's in black and white, everything is cut and dried and clear, but reality is messy. It's not black and white, it's gray. So what we need to do is really expend more resources on discovery, on understanding, on diagnosing what the problems are. That way we can be sure that when we go to solutions, we're solving for the right problem and we're solving things in the right order.
So like Einstein said, if I have 20 days to solve a problem, I spend 19 days defining the problem.
Oh, that's good. Can I use that?
Absolutely. You can keep that. It reminds me a bit of what we do. One method in design thinking is the five whys.
Yes.
Keep on asking why.
Yes.
The problem that I find with that particularly is that it's very easy to go too far and just end up in a place that is, again, very generic, coming from a kind of very symptomatic problem to maybe finding an insight that is relevant to then in the end maybe going as deep as, okay, so there is this Maslow pyramid of needs and this is now within that sector, but then how do you solve for that? So how do you know once a problem is well structured? What does that look like?
Yeah, good point. So we use levels of why as well, and we actually use a visual iceberg exercise, and we teach levels of why. And the metaphor I use is when you're a kid, you used to say why. Like I got a six-year-old, he'll ask why all the time. But in adult conversation, if I keep saying why, you'll want to punch me in the face after I've said it a few times. So people say, how many whys is enough? How do we know when we've gone deep enough? Actually, when we're doing this as a facilitated exercise, you can kind of tell from the dynamic in the room. I mean, the conversation level, the volume and intensity of conversation will go up. And then once they've started to exhaust the possibilities, it'll start to go down again and we'll have a sharing exercise. Usually we'll do it in groups. So you'll have different people working at different stations, so to speak. And then we'll have a sharing in plenary. So different groups share in front of everyone about what they've come up with in terms of the problem structuring. How far have we gone when we know that enough is enough on the problem structure? And usually it's when we have a well-crafted problem statement that people feel captures the problem and articulates it well, so that anyone who's been in the room will know what it is that they're solving for. However, this exercise, it can be 2 hours or it can be a full day. I mean, I did it with a bunch of aeronautical engineers, and the senior engineer in the room after 2 hours said, I think we need more people on this to really understand the complexity of this problem. And I said, you're right. You know, this deserves a full day for this particular problem. So it really depends on the nature of the problem. If it's a simple thing about why are people stealing the stationery, maybe that can be handled quickly. If it's something about the quality of fan blades on jet engines, that's going to be something that's a little bit more time consuming perhaps.
So do you feel there's any sort of problems this wouldn't work for, or just given enough time, enough people, you can always restructure things in a way?
So far, I haven't tried to handle world peace, but I'm willing to give it a try though.
Right. So what scope of problems do you usually encounter, especially in organizations that are looking at digital transformation? Is there any sort of patterns in what kind of problems they would get stuck with?
Yeah, it's often we're dealing with the intersection of business need and customer need and what technology needs to get applied to that need. What we find typically is if organizations skip the problem structuring phase, they'll reach a situation whereby different people in the business get log jammed. It's like in Canada, you've probably seen the pictures of the river where there's lots of logs going down the river to the sawmill, but if there's too many logs, they get stuck and they need to clear the log jam. So we actually worked with a financial services company where they had lots of billion people working on a particular project. But what had happened was there was a complex mix of old and new regulation, old and new process, old and new technology, and they weren't able to clear the logjam until we actually got into the room with them and got their managers talking on all of these issues. And we quickly surfaced about 40 issues. But the default way of talking about the issues was to spend 40 minutes or an hour talking about the issues one by one, and you've got 20 plus people in the room, and usually there's only two or three people talking. So it's basically a mathematical impossibility that you're going to clear all the issues in just a day and a half. So what we then do is work out, okay, which issues need to be discussed today, which can wait till later? And then of the issues that need to be discussed today, what are the, say, the top three? That if we clear those issues, the others might start to clear naturally. And then we basically work in sprints. Another issue with organizations is corporations, no one can be seen to fail.
Yep.
So they don't want to commit 100% to something they know isn't going to work. And generally in a workshop situation, you're not going to come up with something that is 100%. It's just not the nature of the way things are done. So what we tend to say to people is, okay, what confidence level would you guys be comfortable with? Would it be 60% or 70%? Okay, 70%. All right, let's see if we can come up with option A, option B to address each of these issues. We don't need 100% confidence. Just 70% is enough, and then the other 30% you guys can go away and check. So it creates a degree of movement, a degree of commitment, a degree of working towards solving the problem, but it also gives them some wiggle room so they can go out and do the necessary work later. They're not absolutely locked into a particular direction. So that's one example of how we clear the jam.
So when you move from the problem structuring, seeing all of these things, to moving to solutions, what are some of the tools that you have found are really useful to come up with solutions that actually might work and that people would pick up? Are there any specific methodologies that you like to use?
Yeah, so the core methodology we use is design thinking. We also use some other methodologies, systems thinking. We use lean thinking, so, you know, inspired by Lean Startup. The reason I like Lean Startup is that we work on the assumption that there's limited resources. Design thinking on its own can be a bit sort of meandering. It's like a river that doesn't seem to reach the end, whereas Lean Startup assumes that you've got limited runway, you've got limited experiments you can do before you run out of money, run out of time. So we like to sort of overlay those. It's really often, if we're doing solutions, that'll come, say, on day two of a sprint. Day one is normally around empathy and insights in the design thinking methodology, working on problems. Sometimes if there's a lot to tackle, there might even be 2 days on those things. Then we'll get to solutions. I mean, once we've looked at the problems, we tend to like to leave people very hungry.
Yep.
At the end of the day. So they're hungry. You know, what are the solutions? We'll deliberately make them wait until the next day. And it's sort of the thoughts are cooking on the stove of the subconscious mind, if you will. And then
right.
If it's day two or day three, come in and do solutions. It's really, there's various design thinking techniques we'll use to ideate and go through rounds of ideation. And then if we have sufficient time in the sprint, sometimes it can be done back at the office or the agency, or sometimes it can be done in the sprint itself, to come up with lo-fi prototypes. So sometimes the clients say, why not hi-fi prototypes? But it's really just getting enough fidelity in the prototype that we can get the feedback we need to then go and iterate.
Right.
So we've done this kind of thing, for example, several times with a Singapore utilities client here, whereby they don't really have problems in the conventional sense. The service is already excellent, but they're like, we have to improve. So we actually went with them, looked at what is the data telling us about the problems the customers are telling them about. We actually observed customers, interviewed customers in the customer service centers.
Yeah.
And worked up a list of, say, 20 issues. And we worked up personas to personify those issues. We then looked at, okay, what is most viable, feasible, desirable to solve? And we came up with, say, three projects that we then assign internal problem owners and team members to work on and take them through a three-day sprint, which is essentially problem structuring, solutioning, lo-fi prototyping. And we also do what we call a lo-fi business pitch. So we teach them how to pitch the problem, mm-hmm. firstly, and then later the solution prototype to their internal budget holder. So,
right.
You know, boss, we think this is a $500,000 problem. We think that this prototype we're going to demonstrate, we could probably build a digital solution or at least a working prototype for, say, 50K. Can I get a high five to proceed? It's not like a formal approval, but the boss will say, okay, yeah, look, if it can do half of what you say it can, I think this is worth taking forward, but I need a formal business case now. Can you go and put that together for me? So
yeah,
it's like a fuzzy front end, design thinking powered fuzzy front end to their business case and solution feasibility process. Ordinarily, a lot of ideas would get killed quite early were it not for the fact that we get the boss involved looking at the problem. Yes, this is a big problem I want to fix. Looking at the prototype, okay, yeah, I can see that this makes sense. Go and do your homework and come to me with a full proposal.
Yeah. Talking a bit about dynamics in the room during 1 day, 2 day, 3 day workshops, since that can also quite influence the outcomes. What are some of the negative patterns that you have seen, disruptive patterns where people behave in ways that are really not conducive, and how do you deal with that?
Yeah, I usually talk about three styles of workshop. There's sort of like a kittens sort of workshop where everyone's well behaved, and that's more at a sort of a conference where it's like a just this is design thinking, come and experience kind of thing. And there's really not much to go wrong, but there's also not much output for that kind of thing. Then there's the sort of herding cats workshop, and that's try to get people with different perspectives, different professional specializations, different business units moving in the same direction that they themselves have decided upon. That's a bit more challenging. You know, the cats may try and scratch from time to time, scratch each other or the facilitator. And then there's a more difficult facilitation, which comes up from time to time. It's more of a high stakes facilitation where maybe already internally there's a lot of contention. That's a wrestling tigers type of facilitation. Generally, it's about understanding what stage they're at. Is it high stakes or low stakes? Really finding out who are the people and the personalities. We try to discover as much as we can beforehand.
Yeah.
It's not always possible to do that, but if we can anticipate what the issues are, we can sort of handle those better. Usually there's not too many surprises, but we have seen occasions where there's agendas that we weren't aware of coming up in the facilitation, and then what we thought was going to be a herding cats facilitation turns into a wrestling tigers facilitation. So there's various ways and means of handling that. Ideally, though, we try to structure things to minimize the contention by just getting the right people in the room at the right stage.
Right.
So if we know that there's a lot of contention around change or a particular project, what we'll do is start with change-friendly people. So it might be that if you, Sebastian, are the boss of a particular business unit and you're a change leader, we might start with you and a few people who are sympathetic or at least not opposed to what you're doing. And that way we can get a discovery or a picture of what's happening in the organization. Then for the next phase, we might invite in a wider circle of stakeholders. If we're doing a problem structuring workshop, that's a little bit of a different situation where we will purposefully source a lot of contentious and difficult information, because the nature of problem structuring is we need to find out what the gaps and the barriers and the constraints and the contention is. So we'll purposefully involve a lot of people. So it's really looking at where are we in the stage of the process? Is it contentious or not? Is it high stakes or not?
Yeah.
And we also need to know at particular phases there's divergent thinking, which is getting very wide, very broad perspectives, or convergent thinking where we're trying to get consensus on matters. If we're going divergent, generally we get more people in. If it's convergent, it's usually easier with a smaller number of people, but it's not so much the number of people in the room. It's really just the number of problem statements, the amount of complexity involved. But getting the right people in the room at the right stage is key.
How many people do you think, you just said it's not about the number, but I guess there would be like an upper bound or a lower bound, are conducive to actually successful outcomes? Are there limitations?
Yeah, it depends on the type of the workshop. If it's a digital product development sprint, I'd say 7 people is probably the sweet spot. I've done more, I've done less. I've often done sprints with 12 people, which has been absolutely fine if you get the right people in the room. But generally for a sprint, we need people who are... It's fine if they're lateral thinkers and they challenge each other, but it's just knowing at what phase do they need to apply themselves and just get things done. So when we need to diverge, they're happy to diverge. When they converge, they're happy to converge. Generally, people are better at one or the other.
Yeah.
However, if we're talking about a strategy workshop or a road mapping workshop or a retrospective workshop, that's a bit of a different kind of a ball game. For those kind of workshops, I mean, we'll do the discovery is normally a smaller number of people, say, you know, 5 to 7 people, but then typically there's between 20 and 40 people for a road mapping workshop.
Yeah.
I've done 50 or 60 on occasion. It's not so much the number of people that's the issue. It's just are people willing to play ball with the facilitation methodology. I've done 60 with no problem. I've even done 120 with support facilitators, which actually, you know, surprisingly easy if people are willing to play ball. So it's more just people understanding the need to work the process.
Right.
Yeah.
Let's talk specifically a little bit about the role of the leader or the manager. Mm. What behavior would you encourage or discourage from them in such workshops to make sure that you're actually going to get to a place that gets them unstuck?
Yeah, I have to work with the leaders beforehand to understand what kind of behavior is required at each stage of the workshop. And again, the divergent or convergent thinking is the main kind of thing. Sometimes I use hand signals, actually, because sometimes the clients will get very enthusiastic about a particular topic.
Yeah.
I mean, and we'll have, for example, subject matter experts that we invite in for their particular domain expertise. And I remember one workshop where the person in the workshop, Sebastian, ask me what the time is.
What's the time?
Great question. Let me answer that in three parts. First, I'm going to talk about the history of time. Then I'm going to tell you the history of the measurement of time. Then I'm going to tell you how your watch works. So we had a subject matter expert who was brilliant and amazing and wonderful. We absolutely loved and adored her from a content perspective. It's just that it was not very concise.
Yeah.
And when I was trying to sort of steer things in a convergent direction, the client would sort of interrupt and say, wow, that was amazing what you were saying about the history of the sundial. Do you mind just talking a bit more about the measurement of time? So understanding the need to sort of speed things up and concision. So these days I'll try and give the clients a bit of an orientation beforehand if they're not used to facilitated workshops and say essentially, look, there's a lead facilitator and there can be support facilitators, but the lead facilitator sort of decides the direction and the pace. And if you want to take on that role, it's basically, if you break it, you own it.
Right. Did you ever have to escort a participant out of a workshop?
I had a situation where a participant grabbed the microphone out of my hand.
Oh, really?
And I had a situation where I was doing a very contentious workshop where there were two participants started screaming at each other quite early. But actually, these situations I take as, in a way, a healthy sign because it shows people are passionate and engaged, and they both ended up being very, really productive workshops. So I don't think I've ever had to escort anyone out, but occasionally I take people aside and just say, look, at this phase of the workshop, what I need you to do is this, this, and this. I need you to not do this, this, and this. Are you okay with that? And people have always been cooperative, I think. I don't think we've had anyone deliberately throw things off, at least not for too long.
Yeah. Talking about like a group of kittens and herding cats, would you say a certain amount of tension is important or necessary in order to actually make progress?
Yeah, productive tension is good. The other thing that I've done in the past couple of years is usually I'll talk, ideally face-to-face or at least remotely, talk one-to-one with each of the senior participants in the workshop, because in corporations, they're going to have a lot of invested in the workshop and they want to at least feel that their interests are going to be fairly represented.
Right.
And what I usually do is make sure I've understood and I've shown them that I understand their interests. So, for example, a recent engagement, I spoke with the entire senior management team one-to-one before the workshop, and the first thing the CFO said is, justify to me why this won't be a waste of money. You know? But in the end, we got on great, and he ended up being one of the most satisfied participants because I need to understand each of their concerns and drivers, their hopes and fears. And then when they go into the workshop, it makes things a lot smoother. The ice is broken. They have a certain level of faith in the process, and they've understood roughly how the process is going to run. And if there's certain things come up that are unexpected, they know not to panic. It's just part of the process. And as you said, Sebastian, a certain amount of tension, a certain amount of disagreement, this is productive. So what we're trying to do is create not a safe space so much as a brave space, you know, where people can be brave and they can challenge each other. We lay the ground rules. You need to be respectful and productive, but also we don't want people who are just always polite and not challenging ideas, because that's not going to lead to really a deep dive on the problems. That's not going to lead to a level of why. That's not going to lead to the best possible outcome.
Brave space. I like that framing. Mm. I'm going to steal that one.
I think I stole it from someone else.
Doesn't matter. So when we talk about, you mentioned earlier, you also apply system thinking, and sometimes you have clients where there's a ton of problems and it's log jammed. One thing is, of course, to look at the individual problems and see, okay, how can we, you know, get rid of this? But another thing is trying to understand within the system what is maybe also just creating this amount of problems. What are the conditions holding this in place? How do you go about trying to uncover maybe some of these areas where it's not only about addressing one problem, but the cause of why do we have so many problems to begin with?
Yeah, so systems thinking, scenario planning, these kind of methodologies haven't quite got to the level of demand that we're seeing with design thinking. So I think, for example, systems thinking is probably where design thinking was, say, about 7 years ago, where people are starting to get interested in it. They're starting to want to know what it is, how it might be relevant. But we haven't really been actively sort of seeking that kind of business so much, because it just takes too much explaining to the clients. But what we do is, from time to time, we'll incorporate elements of that into the workshops. But I've done some work with NUS, National University of Singapore, systems thinking relating to public policy challenges. So what we do is look at what are the challenges out there, and you know, what's the cause and effect. And if we look at the map of the cause and effect, where are some opportunities where we might design policies for high leverage interventions that can have a disproportionate effect? So that's where we are with systems thinking. Scenario planning was Action Plan Singapore. So that's something I did back in 2016. So, I mean, one of the exciting things about living in Singapore is the government's very proactive in smart cities,
yeah, you know,
digitalization, digital transformation, trying to make Singapore the best it can be on the world stage. I think they really understand the challenges and the opportunities, and they're doing some very smart thinking. There's 23 industry transformation roadmaps out there. They commissioned a Committee for the Future Economy a few years back. So Action Plan Singapore was designed to help inform the Committee for the Future Economy. And we looked at innovation, skills, and longevity and aged care, because aged care in Singapore is very important. It's actually the fourth most aging population in the world in Singapore. So it's partly a byproduct of success in medical care and high standard of living that you know, Singapore is doing so well. And you know, the kind of achievements that have allowed Singapore to be so successful. I mean, Singapore is very successful by any definition as a nation, but I think the opinion leaders in Singapore realize that to succeed in the coming 10 years or 20 years or 50 years requires a new approach, because what got us here isn't going to be the same thinking as what will get us to the next level of advancement. I mean, if you look at indices of ease of doing business, all those kind of international rankings, Singapore is typically number one, number two, or number three.
Yep.
But success going forward may not be so much about maintaining those rankings, useful as that is, but even to think beyond that is almost like, how does Singapore create an entirely new index and sort of blaze the way forward? So the government here sort of wants to make Singapore like the Silicon Valley of Asia, and a startup and innovation hub, or at least of Southeast Asia. It's, so Action Plan Singapore was really looking at scenarios for the future, and you can't predict the future, but you can maybe come up with a range of possible scenarios, and then you can come up with strategies against those. So I think that was probably the most challenging facilitation I did, because there are 120 subject matter experts, and we have to go very, very broad in thinking of all these scenarios. So we spent a full 2 days with each stream, so yep, 6 days in all, coming up with these 12 scenarios. Then we had a conference where we had to, together with 120 people, explore all of these scenarios and then start taking steps towards what kind of strategies might be useful across multiple scenarios. And then we broke people into the three streams again and spent more workshops creating strategies for innovation, skills, and longevity and aged care. And it was published as a report in the end with time-bound strategies against these areas.
So you say systems thinking is where you believe design thinking was 7 years ago. Do you think it's underrated today and actually needs to be applied more?
Oh, I don't mean in terms of development. I just mean in terms of awareness in the business community. I think in the public sector in Singapore, it's fully appreciated. Like Civil Service College, which trains the senior civil servants in Singapore from a postgraduate perspective, they already offer courses and these kind of methodologies. It's just in the business community, I think probably it's not quite as well known.
Yeah. All right. What is maybe the most difficult situation or the most challenging problem you've ever been called in to help, to restructure, to help people get unstuck? Do you have anyone where you would say, okay, this one was really difficult, that was the most challenging one I ever did?
Yeah, I think Action Plan Singapore would have to be the most challenging one, because that's open brief. How do we create the human-centered Singapore of 2026?
So, yeah.
And the challenge statements were, what might our innovation ecosystem of 2026 look like? What might our skills interchange of 2026 look like? And how might our longevity challenge and benefit us in 2026? So those were the three challenge statements. But I already talked about that one a bit, so maybe I'll talk about a different case in a business context. So let me talk about 2011. There was a manufacturer client, so they have thousands of employees, $6 billion corporation. And they were headquartered in the US, and they felt like they were slipping behind their industry par in terms of digital collaboration technology. So that one had more or less an open brief. And it started off with the senior client saying, I'm getting all these different opinions about what I should be doing around digital transformation. Everyone's sending me articles. Everyone's telling me something different. What do I do with all this stuff? So essentially what we came up with was a roadmap. I mean, what was great about this is it was really co-created with the client. So it wasn't all coming from us. The client was actually saying, I want to involve people very widely across the org. I want to start from a blank sheet of paper.
Yeah.
I don't want to have a thud deck, which is like a very heavy multi-page report that makes a noise when you drop it on the desk. You know, I want something that's actionable, that is lived. And I think very smartly, he suggested this shouldn't go silo by silo. I want cross-cutting teams.
Yeah.
So he identified seven areas of business that didn't neatly fit across silos, but were across silos. One of them was in internal collaboration and knowledge sharing, and there was various other parts of the business involving 150 people. So there was a significant number of people across the business involved, a very broad range of professional specializations, to really come up with a set of initiatives that were thinking digital first. And I think there was about 50 pilot ideas came up, and we scored them based on various criteria to bring it down to a short list of about 13. And then finally there were four pilots, and one pilot idea didn't make the final cut just on feasibility and viability reasons, but they ran three pilots each funded into the six figures USD. And these were really quite effective in identifying new ways of engaging with customers and partners. They identified new people they could collaborate with. They found potential partners and customers actually steering them in the direction of a new line of business that they hadn't really thought of, and that they were able to think, hey, this can be a productive line of business for us that arose out of a pilot activity. So that one was very interesting. The thing was that we were actually sent in as consultants. This is when I worked in a digital agency to slow things down in a way, because they got to the point in the US where people were so enthusiastic that they were going off, and with the consumerization of IT, they were setting up new tools, new technologies without IT's approval. And
right.
There was sort of a fight that went all the way up from the BU level up to the CEO. And the CEO had ended up saying, look, I'm going to support IT because you guys are doing a whole range of things that are not on IT support list. But we need a strategy here. We need a roadmap. We need things to happen in a logical order. So we were sort of sent in as the consultants to make things happen in a logical, sort of orderly way, collaborating with the organization. The only thing was that process back in 2011 was quite time-consuming. So
yeah.
it took up most of my time for about 9 months.
And oh, well.
Some corporations might think, oh, yeah, that's not too bad. But since that project, most of my work's been focused on Southeast Asia,
yeah.
Where things need to happen faster, cheaper, happier, you know. So
always.
Yeah, so what we do now is really, it's a matter of days or weeks, not months. And a lot of it is workshop-based purely from the fact that getting a lot of people together physically is a fast way and usually a very time-efficient way of getting to where they need to go.
Yeah. So for leaders who are maybe just now brought in, there's still many legacy industries which are just starting to approach digital transformation and seeing what does it actually mean for us, often bringing in the sole hero who's supposed to start that process. What would your recommendations be for how to even find orientation and where to start?
I'm going to say start with why. I'm a fan of Simon Sinek's start with why. If you think about your why, it's your mission. Who do you exist for? Who do you provide value for? That's really the core question if you're thinking digital transformation. If you're thinking digitalization just to apply technology on top of a process, that's fine. That's legit. I mean, if, for example, you're a bank, trying to transform everything at once, given your regulation and your legacy and your habitual ways of thinking, it's going to be quite hard to transform the whole beast. So you logically start with a few things on the edge.
Right.
Stuff like communications is relatively easy to innovate. Customer experience, and I'm sort of thinking concentric circles here. You know, as you go in, there's like things like customer experience, and then there's process.
Yes.
And then if you go in even further, there's business model or revenue model and product, if you will, or service lines. But really at the core, there's mission. And I would encourage people to think about what is the mission you're trying to fulfill here, because if you don't get that bit updated and re-expressed for this day and age, you're kind of at risk. And, you know, the banks, for example, recent example, I know of a startup where they were banking with a particular large bank and their online banking system will only show 6 months of past statements. And
right.
Then for compliance reasons, they needed a bank statement from about a year ago. So they had to go into the bank, pay $30 per month for a printed statement.
Oh, come
on. So they ended up paying $60 for 2 months worth of statements. And this is just the way the bank works, that they think it's logical and justifiable to the customers to charge $60 for two sets of printed statements. When, if they were really thinking digital first, why wouldn't they just offer a longer time horizon of statements online? So I don't know, maybe it's from a data storage perspective that they feel they don't want to do that, but then they're at risk from maybe a disruptive innovator who comes in and says, we'll just make your statements available for a year, 10 years, maybe even further back. Because this is the kind of thing that's going to annoy the hell out of customers.
Right.
But you're asking, where do people start? I mean, I'd say, start with why. Why are you doing this? Who are you solving for? I mean, to me, innovation, there's lots of definitions, but to me, it's adding value to customers. You know, if it's innovation, it's adding value to customers in a cost-effective way, in a way that's viable and feasible for the organization.
Yeah.
So beyond that, I'd say prioritization. And prioritization for us, usually the first thing we'll do in a workshop is the hopes and fears exercise, which you can see on the Innovator SG website. But it's really about getting key people in the room and thinking of the business, thinking of customers, thinking of the next, usually we say 2 years. What are your hopes? What do you want to happen? What are your fears? What do you don't want to happen? So that exercise on its own, it only takes 20 or 30 minutes, is quite an eye-opener. And whether it's the CEO, whether it's the business unit leader, or whether it's the head of IT, seeing their people come up with these sets of hopes and fears quickly unearths a lot of interesting insights. And I've done this around the region. I think the first time I did it outside Singapore was in Thailand, and I wasn't sure if it would work in Thailand. And I don't speak Thai, but I heard these shouts and screams and laughter. And I asked the managers, what are they saying? And
right.
The managers are saying to their people, why didn't you tell us about these things? So they had, I think, about six whiteboards full of insights that they then wrote down, because it's called the dripping roof syndrome, yeah, where no one wants to tell the boss that there's a leaky roof.
Right.
And then the first thing the boss might know about the leaky roof is when the roof collapses.
Yeah.
Eventually. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, prioritization is really key, isn't it? I learned recently that until a certain point in time, the word priority didn't have a plural. Because it's really about being exclusive about what to focus on.
Yeah.
And there can only be one priority. You cannot have multiple priorities.
Yeah.
That's how it used to be.
Yeah, true. Yeah, it reminds me of a consultant I know who had a sign on his wall and it said ruthless prioritization. It was there to remind him and the team that they need to focus and execute against their core priorities, because I was recently helping a client on this, and it came up again and again, the tension between doing what is a core priority and what is non-core. And this was an early stage company, a successful early stage company, a well-funded, venture-funded company. And there's always the feeling of doing the urgent, putting out fires, which is necessary to an extent, but then that's time not spent on important but not urgent things. So that's another sort of problem people have with prioritization. So it came up in a big way during the workshop that leadership needs to constantly reinforce what are the core priorities. And it's the sometimes it means saying no to things that are actually very good and very important, but it's just we're not focusing on that right now. And sometimes what happens is the customers are angry about something, but particularly if you're an early stage company, you don't have the resources to please everyone all the time.
Right.
Even large corporations can struggle with that.
Yeah, I've seen it so many times. Larger initiative going on should be the key priority, but then along the way, somebody complains about something and this is just a quick fix. Let's just go in, spend a week there, we'll fix it, spend a week there, we'll fix it. And just spending so much time on fixing stuff left and right that in the end, the big initiative gets delayed by months and everything that was fixed along the way gets thrown away anyways because that's all supposed to be replaced instead of just living with that pain a little bit longer and just focusing on what's actually important. That is a recurring pattern.
It's shiny objects and sharp elbows. So shiny objects are the things that, oh, that looks nice, getting distracted by that. And the sharp elbows are when the customer maybe complains about something and all attention can naturally go there. Because people are helpful. They want to do the right thing.
Right.
Yeah.
So now we have our soul heroes supposed to transform the enterprise.
Yeah.
They found their why. How do they actually get the first people inside of the enterprise to work with them because they can't do it themselves. They need to work with the business unit. How do they find somebody who's willing to actually take a chance and say, yeah, I'm willing to transform my process. You can help me. Let's do something.
Yeah, so I'd say again that it's usually identifying people who are change-friendly or at least not change-opposed. And it's not being discouraged by the initial response because sometimes there's legacy. Sometimes things have been tried and failed. But if you can tap into the personal motivators, the hopes and fears, you know, the reason we normally start with hopes and fears is that what moves people is not necessarily logic or reason so much as emotion. So if you can tap in for something that's really heartfelt, that can work. Like I saw one organization where there was one manager who was very creative, very good lateral thinker, and she was in a conservative kind of organization, and people had sort of judged her as coming up with stuff that's overcomplicated or unrealistic. But I saw right away she's an innovator. And so sometimes it's just supplying that person with the reinforcement. No, what you're saying actually makes a lot of sense, you know, and I know you're going up against people who may be casting doubt on what you're saying, but all you really need is two or three people to start supporting you and then others will start coming. So it's partly we can go in and see where those people are. You know, we can see it in a facilitated session. We can see it in interviews and start plugging people together in a right way that the group dynamics can work in your favor in terms of change. They can work against. But if you know how to work the group dynamics the right way, you can focus those in a productive direction.
Yeah. Often at the beginning, people are given quite some leeway, have some space to experiment. The antibodies only kick in 3-6 months down the road, a year down the road.
Yeah.
How can you protect this little island of transformation that's supposed to basically envelop the whole nation from these antibodies that start kicking in down the road?
Island of transformation, yeah, that's a good phrase. In fact, some corporations have even looked at next generation procurement models whereby they will have a kind of a sandbox environment whereby they know that certain freedom exists. Not so much freedom as just special KPIs exist whereby it's understood that while an experiment or a pilot is in its learning phase, the main KPIs are around learning and validation, and the revenue expectation doesn't kick in necessarily right away. Because if you apply the standard corporate KPIs to an innovation project right away, the amount of time it takes to validate the project and get it up and running might be longer than the corporate span of patience.
Right.
So it's partly understanding the difference between what is called, there's a very good book I like on this topic called Beyond the Idea, which talks about the innovation engine and the productivity engine and the performance engine. Yeah, the performance engine is basically the standard business that makes money, that has the standard KPIs, which is absolutely essential. So you can't disrespect the performance engine. That's what makes the money. And by this definition, what the innovation engine comes up with in terms of new product or new service, new line of revenue, once that's been validated, by definition, it gets passed to the performance engine that does things in a systematic, repeatable way. So I think one mistake innovators can sometimes make is to disrespect the core business, the performance engine, when that is the thing that makes the money.
Right.
On the other hand, the performance engine people can tend to view innovation as impractical or impracticable because it doesn't make money right away. So it's understanding that separate KPIs are required. So, but then there's another layer here, which is culture. And corporate culture, put it this way, no manager really wants to own failure. So I've spoken to a lot of organizations, and sometimes they've candidly told me they've given up trying to teach experimentation within the context of the performance engine because no one wants to own failure. So as you say, maybe they need to set up a particular island of experimentation where there's a different kind of KPIs and rules apply, at least temporarily. And I think it's having the right kind of air cover in terms of management, that there needs to be a core of leadership that understands the way this thing works. Because I think what we've seen happen from time to time is just when that zone of experimentation, island of experimentation, is starting to work, the corporate will go, it's not making us any money. We haven't really seen any breakthrough innovation yet. So let's shut the baby down, you know. And it's like expecting your baby to do the 100 meters in 10 seconds when it's still only 4 years old. It's starting to walk and run, but it's not quite there yet. So I think it's really understanding what is required in different parts of the organization to achieve the different outcomes.
When 90 or 99% of all the people in the organization talk one language and one set of KPIs, it takes incredible discipline to say, no, this is not actually what we need here. We need another set of KPIs, which are about learning, about progress. It's not about revenue. It's not about ROI. How can anybody find the sort of, was it an internal political power to actually be able to hold a hand over that and protect it? Can it only happen in the C-level?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So the 2011 project I mentioned, the senior manager who initiated the project had been with that organization, I think, for nearly 20 years. So he knew how to play very nicely with everyone so that he could get people on board. He knew all the personalities, all the processes. So he was able to play with everyone very nicely so that we were able to do that kind of project. And you know, having that kind of person to work with was wonderful. If you're someone who doesn't have that level of experience or seniority or length of service in the organization, it's going to be a little bit more of a challenge. You're going to have to be good at, I know the term managing up is a bit of a politically loaded term, it's got a negative connotation, but you're going to have to be good at explaining to your bosses, and not just your bosses, but your peers and people in other parts of the org, you know, why this is important to do. So I guess there's two ways of looking at this. If you're going into a role, you might have to have the conversation at the beginning. You know, this is, you know, you say you want me to go in and innovate. What is going to happen if someone who's been at the organization for 5 years comes and complains about my project? How are you going to handle that conversation? Just to sort of prepare the fact that innovation will generate a certain amount of resistance, at least initially. Once it's proven to work, a lot of people want to claim credit.
Right.
But earlier on, you know, people might say, oh, you know, this is conflicting with my project, or this person, you know, it seems to be creating waves. So if you're going into an organization, you might just want to ask plenty of curveball questions to see if you're going to get the support you need. And you're going to need support of more than just one person. You know, what happens if you're hired in by someone who leaves 6 months after you've joined? You know, you want to have multiple people who are backing you. If you're already in the organization, that's going to be a slightly different ballgame. I mean, it's going to depend on your personality, how you play that game. If you're more sort of go with the flow kind of person, you might sort of spend some time just observing how things work, you know, what the agendas are, who the people are, spend some time fitting in. If you're a more front foot sort of person, you might take a different approach. So I think it's more of a case by case for that.
So it sounds like one of the skill sets or profiles that people would actually need on a successful transformation team is a politician or a lobbyist who actually goes out and has a coffee here, a coffee there, smooths it over with people, understands their agendas.
Yeah, indeed. So it's interesting to look at the way different innovators work in different organizations. I mean, I've seen some innovation teams who are the quiet achievers and do great work, but then if they don't get the word out, their projects might not get funded.
Right.
And then I've seen some that probably are more on strong on the communication side. They're very good at sort of getting the word out, and then they might strategically think, look, we need to be seen to succeed so that we can continue to get funded. And they strategically might think, well, we're not going to try and transform the whole elephant. We'll just try to, you know, eat one piece at a time. So I think it's really looking at your org and what is doable.
So for your own work, then, when do you see what you do as successful?
Mm.
When would you say, okay, I've done my job, I have delivered great results for a client? What does it look like for you?
Yeah, well, I think for any business, it's when the client feels like they've made the correct decision in working with you. And there's many answers to that question. I'd like to see that every engagement we've had with them at every step of the way has been a successful one. It doesn't always mean that every step is comfortable, because sometimes we will deliberately make people uncomfortable for a strategic reason,
right,
which is to create that brave space to advance the conversation. But really, we'd like to see a situation where there's clarity around problems. There's some kind of solutions roadmap that the organization is bought into, that there's movement on the projects within that roadmap, and ideally that there's traction around projects or pilots or new products and services that are launched so that they can see the value.
Thinking about the various markets in which you've worked already, what kind of phases of digitalization do organizations go through?
Yeah, so it's coming back to that distinction between digitalization and digital transformation. So I think a lot of what we see is more digitalization, whereby they've made a pragmatic decision that we're not going to be able to transform everything in one go. Let's sort of start at the edges and sort of work our way in. It may be accompanied by a rethink at the core, but I guess probably the phases that we see people go through is more around, where can we play the game effectively? Where can we transform? And there's a trade-off to be made between moving ahead of the competitors, or at least, you know, not getting eaten to death by the competitors. But on the other hand, we don't want to disrupt ourselves so much that we leave ourselves in a state of disarray.
Right.
Yeah. So I'd say that, you know, the natural sort of progression is to start at the edge around communications and marketing. Often companies do something around social media or chatbots, that kind of thing, which can be great for the PR. And I don't mean to sound cynical, because I mean, I actually come from a technology public relations background in the early days. So I think it's necessary that you need to achieve some early wins so that you can then fuel things on. And, you know, there might be some achievements around using a particular way of marketing to get customers in an innovative way.
Right.
And then if that is seen as a success, we go, okay, hey, let's do a new product, or even start thinking from a digital perspective on a whole new line of business or product. But I think for organizations to really survive in the next 5 to 10 years and avoid getting nibbled to death by smaller competitors, or even to have some of the big technology companies come in and sideswipe them completely, to really think about the core mission, why do we exist? And that may require a bit of a rethink in this digital age. And what are the new ways that we can create value? What problems are we going to need to overcome to do that, and then to apply the technology? Because I think too often the technology is a bit like fashion shopping. You know, it's just, I'll buy myself a new shirt. It's sort of skin deep kind of thinking. And another thing we've noticed in workshops is that the breadth and depth of technology understanding is sort of the box which creates the constraint. This, I'm talking about people who are business unit people rather than IT people. And you could argue the opposite, which is the IT people need to understand the business. And there's another thing that we're seeing starting to happen. You know, the old thinking on IT, the best practice was IT isn't the business, they exist to serve the business. But that's right. Already kind of old thinking, because IT can now be a driver of business growth in new technologies, new business models. So I think really having that shared technology and business understanding is quite important. We've even started in certain workshops having a particular game at the beginning where there's a set of business challenges that need to be solved, and then there's a set of technologies that people deploy, and we get people talking about technology and how it fits together and how it can be used to solve business challenges, because creating that broad and deep understanding of how technology and business interplay, I think is quite key to this.
Yeah, the role of technology in business is interesting. Specifically, IT usually used to be a cost center, as you say, serve the business. And now still, oftentimes, you have a CIO. And now in parallel comes up the chief digital officer.
Mm.
So suddenly you have information technology and digital being separate things, where often digital is looking after things that could maybe be revenue creating and then create business. And IT is still somehow stuck in the old world.
Yeah, I remember 10 years ago or 10 plus years ago, I was a project manager, and I remember a head of IT saying, guys, he was saying to his team, guys, we are not the business, we exist to serve the business. He drummed it into them repeatedly. And back then, that was probably, you know, best practice thinking. But more recently, I was working with a regional head of IT in Hong Kong, and he's trying to instill a new way of thinking in his team, which is we need to empower the business. We need to be like the next wave of change, because they're already market leader in Asia. They've already got 40% share. So the only way to really move ahead is to through this kind of innovation.
Besides the various stages of digital transformation or digitalization that you just described, typically this also needs a kind of rethinking of the organizational culture of how people work. How do you see that? Because oftentimes, at least in our work, this very quickly becomes a blocker to the higher stages of realizing the real value from digital transformation.
Yeah, there's a couple of things there. There's the tyranny of the urgent. I mean, people naturally tend to focus on what's right in front of them. It's strategic pragmatism. You know, I understand that, you know, longer-term strategy might be important, but I need to execute on what's in front of me. I had one manager once tell me, he pointed it across the room and he said, I don't try and put out a fire when it's over there. I wait till it burns right on my leg before I try and put it out. So I think there's that tyranny of the urgent. There's professional role specializations where you need to focus on what's right in front of you. But I think organizations also need to periodically get together. And I've even got clients who want to do this now on a quarterly basis, to periodically get together, say, how are we going on these kind of innovation projects? What else do we need to be doing? To look at the innovation KPIs and the business KPIs and sort of plug those two conversations together, because they're separate and but also related and important to integrate.
Yeah, that's also an interesting point, because transformation is not really going from point A to point B. I mean, technically you could frame it as such, but then now everything is speeding up and basically you're going to have to constantly transform yourself. So it almost has to become a habit.
Yeah.
How can we instill this habit in a large organization with 10,000, 100,000 people, even if they quote unquote successfully digitally transformed themselves and now the next wave is coming, they always need to be on their toes and keep on adapting. How is that possible?
Yeah, so transformation of mindset, I think, is really important. It's the most challenging. You've got DBS, the CEO there, aspires to make it a 22,000 person startup. So they're looking at transformation there. They've done some interesting things involving internal hackathons, internal sprints. They've done a lot of interesting stuff on innovation. I think it was as early as 2010 when I first became a DBS customer. I was super impressed by the account sign up process. So it was tablet based. They'd really done some very nice thinking on the process. Felt like a VIP going in and doing it. So I was super impressed by a lot of stuff they've done. But then on the other hand, there's other stuff that is still old school, because it can't transform everything at once.
What would you say are the three biggest mistakes that you have seen in transformation efforts, and how can those be avoided?
Yeah, so I think it's looking at technology like it's a set of clothes that can be just put on and somehow that's going to transform everything. It's not starting with the why. About why are we doing it in terms of who are we doing this for, how are we going to add value, really starting with the basics there and then building out. And it's also not having a robust process around things. Sometimes just jumping into activity, having a whirlpool of activity isn't the best way of doing things. It's actually taking a bit of a pause and thinking about how we're going to take things forward. And there is a balance between, you don't want to try and change the whole elephant at once if you're a large corporation. On the other hand, you do want to have some kind of systematic thinking in there.
So it's basically, don't look at technology as the means, but rather technology as an enabler.
Mm.
Have a proper process in order to move forward, and start small, but always with the bigger picture in mind.
Yeah, I mean, the old people process tools, it's a bit outdated now, a bit simplistic, but you talk about other things like data that are very important. But, you know, it starts with people for a reason, and process comes next for a reason. You skip those two, and whatever technology you apply is likely to go wide of the mark. It might be an expensive white elephant, or it might just lead to a sort of logjam situation.
Right. John, thank you very much for your time.
Enjoy.
It's been a real pleasure having you on. And yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Sebastian.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Lost in Transformation with our host, Sebastian from Ming Labs. If you enjoy our podcast, please subscribe to our channel and leave us a review on iTunes. Join us next time for another episode of our podcast.